Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Pioneering filmmaker Spike Lee pried his way into Hollywood via Brooklyn. In 1986, through sheer willpower and a lot of help from family, he brought us She's Gotta Have It, and then the Spike Lee gusher. Do the Right Thing, Mo Better Blues, Jungle Fever, Malcolm X, He Got Game, Summer of Sam, and a whole lot more. Along the way, Spike Lee helped launch the careers of Halle Berry, Samuel Jackson, Lawrence Fishburne, Denzel Washington, Rosie Perez, and a lot more. And he changed the way America's races thought about and talked to each other. For a man who hates to compromise, it's been no easy climb. Spike Lee has bruised egos along the way and been bruised. He's been hit and miss at the box office and never taken an Oscar. But he's made bold, honest, strikingly successful films and a deep cultural imprint in a path-breaking and much-celebrated career. This hour, On Point, Spike Lee, on his life and work in American cinema. You can join the conversation. Do you remember when you first saw She's Gotta Have It, Do the Right Thing, Jungle Fever? Do you remember your first encounter with the work of Spike Lee, with the Spike Lee attitude? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We are told Spike Lee is en route right now to a studio in New York. We are happily joined from there already by Kaleem Aftab, author of the biography Spike Lee, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. Kaleem Aftab, thanks very much for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, it's great to have you. So Malcolm X had Alex Haley, Spike Lee has Kaleem Aftab. But you're a freelance writer, a TV director in the UK, written for The Independent, Hot Dog, The List. How did you come to work with Spike Lee as told to Kaleem Aftab?
About 3 years ago, I was interviewing Spike for a magazine in London, and I knew at that stage that a publishing company wanted me to write a book on Spike. But during the interview, I wasn't brave enough to ask him outright. But later on at a party, in his honour for the BAFTA award that he got, Lifetime Achievement, I actually just ran up to him at a party, asked him if he was interested in me doing a book on him, gave him a spiel, and he said yes. And amazingly, I ran away, of course, as soon as he said that, so he couldn't change his mind.
Right.
And as I was leaving the party, from across the room, Spike yelled out, "Don't forget to call me about the book."
And now we've got it. Spike Lee, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. We're looking forward to hearing from him in just a couple of minutes here. But tell us, Kaleem Aftab, who's the man that you found? You talked with so many people he's worked with, people in his family, a lot with Spike Lee himself. He's obviously been very cooperative in this. Americans know him from the film and from the attitude there and from the many facets he's shown off there. Who did you find?
I found a man who was initially quite shy, which surprised me because that's not the public persona that's been given. And then when I got to know him, I found a man who was occasionally quite hard to work with, in terms of you do have to sometimes walk around eggshells. But eventually I found a man who was very kind, very generous, great with his time, and most importantly, a man who was a workaholic.
And we can see that in the production, the output of films over all these years. How would you describe, apart from what you found directly, what's the public myth, legend, persona built up around Spike Lee? How would you describe that one?
I think before I met Spike, I was told that he was quite cantankerous, quite angry, was difficult to talk to, and he'd built up over the years this vision of a man who shouts a lot. And I was surprised that he was none of the above.
With you, of course, you're writing his biography. What about the people you've spoken with who worked with Spike Lee on the set, on projects? How do they see him?
I think it's very interesting that different people saw him in different ways, and it very much depended on their relationship. I think actors see Spike very differently to his crew. Many of the actors talked about a man who would, for example, Rosie Perez definitely felt that Spike was a bit heavy-handed. She was very young, and she suggested that Spike almost took advantage of her youth, although I believe that's a bit strong.
Took advantage in pushing her into a career that
in
she...
In pushing her into doing the very famous Ice Cube sequence that everybody loves to remember. Mm-hmm.
Describe that sequence for us, Colleen, for people who don't know it.
It's a sequence in Do the Right Thing, and Spike Lee plays Mookie, a pizza mm-hmm. delivery boy, and his girlfriend and mother of his child is Rosie Perez, and he goes to deliver a pizza to her, and when he arrives, they start making love, and Spike very famously because it's the hottest day of the year, Spike gets some ice cubes out of the fridge, walks over to her, and very gently caresses her breasts with these ice cubes.
And they melt, and there's history, and Rosie Perez feeling a little... maybe a little used there. On the other hand, Spike Lee has helped propel a lot of careers of African-American actors in particular. We should take us through that list, Kaleem Aftab. It's kind of impressive, and what he did for each.
It's amazing. Even from his first film, he used actors that, especially African-American actors, that nobody had heard of. From She's Gonna Have It, there was Tracy Camilla Johns, who I always remember, although she didn't go on to be a megastar, I always remember that as a young man, I wanted to take out She's Gonna Have It from the video store just because of her picture. But the video store owner just told me I was way too young to watch a film like that. And then obviously from school days, there was Samuel L. Jackson, or mm-hmm. Sam Jackson, as he was known there, mm-hmm. Playing a yogi, a local town person. And he obviously then went on to appear in Do the Right Thing and in Mo Better Blues.
And he's so big now, but we're talking just the mid-late 80s there. At what point in his career was Samuel Jackson when Spike Lee brought him in?
Nobody had heard of him. I'd not heard of him. You'd not heard of him. He'd just done a few theater productions, and Spike knew him from his days at Morehouse. A very similar story to Bill Nunn, to Larry Fishburne. Larry Fishburne obviously had started with Apocalypse Now, but Spike really propelled him by putting him into School Days. And the same can be said. Rosie Perez he found in a nightclub in L.A.
She was a dancer, and he said, "You've got to be in film."
She was dancing on top of a speaker in a club called Funky Go-Go, I believe, and Spike saw her, enamored by her, obviously, and as soon as Rosie opened her mouth and she's got that voice, Spike knew that she was destined to be a movie star.
Halle Berry, Denzel Washington, huge.
Huge, huge. Halle Berry was a model when Spike picked her up. Spike really didn't believe that Halle Berry had it in her to play a crack addict in the film, and Halle actually proved to Spike by turning up dressed as a crack addict that she could do the part, and obviously she's such a wonderful actress. Denzel, what can you say about Denzel? Formidable career. Spike actually cast him in Mo Better Blues, which was his first major lead role, and this was just before he'd even been awarded the Oscar, supporting actor in Oscar for Glory. Mm. And Denzel has obviously gone on to make Malcolm X, which was quite possibly, in my book, his most wonderful performance. Then he got Game with Spike, and now he's making a new film with Spike called Inside Man.
Right, Inside Man. You come to 2003, the so-called Black Oscars then, when Spike's Denzel Washington and Halle Berry, of course, back-to-back Best Actor and Best Actress.
Yeah, and it was noticeable that in Halle Berry's speech that she did take time out to thank Spike Lee. Spank Spike Lee? Oh!
That's good. That's good.
That's the uncensored version.
Yeah, we like it. You looked at, as Spike Lee has often looked at, the legacy, the history of black filmmakers, how hard it's been for African-Americans to break into this business, back to Oscar Micheaux and Gordon Parks, Melvin Van Peebles. Before Spike Lee, remind us what that terrain looked like, Kaleem Aftab.
Well, when Spike came on board in 1986, there was only one director who was working consistently, African-American director, who was working consistently in Hollywood, and that was Michael Schultz, who made some wonderful films over that period. But obviously Spike came on board and he wanted to do a film that was not an Eddie Murphy vehicle, not a blaxploitation picture. He wanted to tell a story about middle class life in Brooklyn as he knew it, and a middle class black African American population that was not talked about in American film and not seen on film. And just by doing that, he managed to capture the hearts of not just people in America and African Americans, but second generation people around the world.
By going to a middle class story, but he really went also straight at the story of racial identity and racial tension.
That's very true. I think it's less so in, I mean, it's mentioned upon in She's Gotta Have It, and I think people remember that as being a story of racial tension because it was the first film that was by a black director and had black stars. I think he really took the film and commentary on black and African, what it means to be African American, to another level in School Days, where he discussed for the first time on the I'd scene, and definitely the first time in film, the division between light skin and dark skin African Americans, which I think was the elephant that no one wanted to speak about in the room.
This is kind of inside the race or the culture conversation that was not normally shared.
Yeah, I believe everybody was so into the discussion that you saw in Do the Right Thing of black, white, racial division, that to hear about intra-black division was phenomenal.
Well, here we are. Well, with Kaleem Aftab, he has written a new biography of Spike Lee, kind of as told to, called Spike Lee, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. We are waiting for Spike Lee himself to arrive in the studio. Pray for the traffic to clear. You can join our conversation. Do you remember when you first saw She's Gotta Have It, Do the Right Thing, Jungle Fever? What does Spike Lee stand for to you in cinema, in American culture, in black American culture? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about, and we hope very soon, to filmmaker Spike Lee, about his life and work in American cinema. We're joined in the hour by Kaleem Aftab. He is author of Spike Lee, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. It's kind of as told to biography of Spike Lee. Let's get a sense of Spike Lee in the house. Just be reminded for a minute here from She's Gotta Have It, his breakout film, 1986, I guess, Kaleem, is that right?
Right, 1986, right? It was released.
Here's Nola Darling in She's Gotta Have It, played by Tracy Camilla Jones. She's invited her three boyfriends, including Spike Lee, playing bicycle messenger Mars Blackman, for Thanksgiving dinner in She's Gotta Have It.
No, is this the first Thanksgiving you cooked?
The very first.
The first?
Mm-hmm.
The very first?
Uh-huh.
It's good. This is first, all right?
The first.
Okay.
Honey, this food is indicative of marrying material.
Marrying material? No, darling would never marry a non-modeling, non-weightlifting, pseudo-black man like yourself.
That's it. I've had it.
Mm. Pass the cranberry sauce.
Cranberry sauce? No, Jamie, you're okay. You know, I've been thinking. I'm going to hook you up. With Nola, you get 4 days, I'll get three.
That's mighty black of you.
But I get the weekend, so.
That's mighty black of you in She's Gotta Have It, Spike Lee's big first breakout film. And, of course, there you have three black men competing over Thanksgiving dinner for the attentions of Nola Darling, who was openly, sexually, voracious in this film. Kaleem Aftab is with us. We're joined as well, as we wait for Spike, by Tricia Rose, our good friend, professor of American Studies at the University of California in Santa Cruz, author of Black Noise, Rap Music, and Black Culture in Contemporary America. Tricia Rose, thank you very much for jumping in here with us. It's great to have you.
It's my pleasure to be here, Tom.
It's great to have you. How do you see Spike Lee in the American film tradition, and in particular in Black America's kind of arrival in American film?
I think he's extremely important, both in American film and extraordinarily important in black cinema. I mean, it was a pivotal moment when his work took hold in the popular imagination, because it made possible the idea that a non-Hollywood-based, non-sort of mainstream conception of everyday black life and intimacy and relationships and history could be told from this perspective and be understood as valuable and interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of emphasis on him, a sort of phrase of him being the sort of black Woody Allen, which I've never really liked.
Woody Allen, because he's in his own films, because he's gone his own way.
Yes, I see the parallels, definitely, and New Yorker, focusing on a New York consciousness. And, you know, as a New Yorker, I've always really enjoyed that. But I think that what's more important about what he does is that, I mean, Spike Lee had to do this against, really, an industry that hadn't really allowed black artists to have this kind of power, and that's not the case for someone like Woody Allen, that's number one.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, black relationships, I mean, the humanity of African-Americans in cinema has not been its strong suit, right? It's been about dancing and laughing and entertaining or being violent and aggressive and urban and gang-like, and
right.
Spike Lee was always working against those, even as he was sometimes working in those spaces in certain films. He was working against that conception. I mean, where else do you have characters like the ones that Spike Lee plays, a kind of almost a black egghead, you know, who's sort of, you know, corny or, you know, weird or, you know, he's got big shoes and big glasses and,
right.
you know, making fun of himself, but at the same time saying, look, there are kids like this, you know, this full range of who black people are. And I think it was very, very important, very important.
So give us some range. Kalima Aftab, what about it? Spike Lee has often shown this kind of surly attitude toward the world, but Tricia Rose is quite right in saying, of course, you know, what he exposed was a lot more intimacy, not pumped up, not exactly hip-hop hard in his films, a willingness to show vulnerability, black vulnerability.
I believe that's very true, and also what's true is the characters that he showed were very much from, I mean, I think it's very interesting that they were from not just from the middle classes, which was very much in the first film, but for Do the Right Thing, you had the working class characters who weren't just big thugs that we see even today in very many gangster, black gangster films. And Spike, he does come across as surly, but I think that's more a comment on the mainstream than a comment on Spike, because he was saying things that nobody had managed to get themselves on a platform to be able to say. And a lot of times the mainstream didn't like it.
You go straight at, in the book, the story of Spike's mother and father. His father, Bill Lee, a jazz musician, bassist. His mother, who died in her early 40s, when Spike was at Morehouse College, the famous black college where his parents had also attended. But a real shock to Spike Lee, and then compounded with the shock that his father, sooner than he would have liked, took up with, is that the right phrase, a white woman. Echoes of this in a lot of Spike's work, and a real problem despite his ongoing work with the family. Bill Lee did a lot of soundtrack work on a lot of Spike's film, but that has left a real chasm between these two men, as you describe it, Kalima Aftab.
Yeah, I believe that the chasm between the men isn't about that, but more about his father's drug use. He was, like many jazz musicians of the 60s onwards, addicted to hard drugs, and that created a chasm. I believe, thinking back and looking back on it, that yes, Spike was very upset with Bill, but I think he would have been upset whether the woman he took up with was black or white, and I think he sees that now. But at the time, as a young man, it just added to the pain that his father, so soon after his mother, that he loved dearly, that he believes that because of his mother's death, the only way he rationalized it himself is that that gave him the impetus to become a filmmaker. And if his mother didn't die, he would not have become a filmmaker. And I feel that represented itself when Bill Lee took up with Susan Kaplan. But I believe that you can see that Spike wasn't that frustrated by it, because he still used his father in the first films, all the way up to Mo Better Blues, to do the soundtrack and to compose the score. And it was only after the drug incident when Bill Lee was arrested and...
What year was that? What drug?
It was heroin, and it was just around 1990, and his use got much bigger, and I believe that's partly why Spike didn't use his father on Jungle Fever, and definitely why.
But, of course, in this aborted film project, The Messenger, that he tried to mount coming out of NYU Film School, the climactic scene was to have been essentially Spike pushing a white woman down a staircase, an interloper woman, seemed very parallel to his personal story. A little frustration being expressed right there.
I think that's definitely true, and I think you can almost say that the frustration still rears itself in some ways with Jungle Fever. But he was also talking about subject matter and about the fear of black men or black women being taken by the mainstream, being taken by the Caucasians, and the rejection of slavery. And you could adapt quite just as easily say it's from a historical perspective, but definitely there is, and the personal there became political because it was so close to that story. And he wanted to show this story to the world because it pained him in his own life.
Mm. Kalim Aftab, Tricia Rose, it's great to have you both. We're making something, a silk purse, out of Spike Lee's absence at the moment. He's caught in traffic on the way to his studio, but it's wonderful to have you with us. And a lot of people are already crowding up to the bar to join. Let me begin to turn to them, if I may. Ifanya is calling from Boston. Ifanya, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I just called. I wanted to comment with, I've met Spike Lee a few times and talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to talk about the whole concept of him being sort of this. I think his success has sort of been bittersweet in that he's sort of been pigeonholed into sort of the crier for all things African-American. I think being able to tell a story is a privilege in the United States, and storytellers are often people of power. And I think when Spike Lee has had the opportunity, he's told wonderful stories, but there haven't been a lot of other African-American directors who have had his kind of success. I mean, there are a few others, John Singleton, the Hughes brothers, and others. But for the most part, I feel like Spike Lee has been sort of pigeonholed. And I think that shows through from some of the other films, like The 25th Hour, which was a fantastic film with Ed Norton.
This is the hour, of course, where Ed Norton has got just a day before he heads off to prison, and quite an extraordinary events of that day. A lot of white actors there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And also Summer of Sam, which was a fantastic film.
And almost entirely white.
One of Spike Lee's best, which was the entire cast did for Esposito and some other actors who were doing fantastic work, but they didn't do very well. And I think as soon as you get an African-American telling stories that aren't their own or aren't expected, I think you get into a lot of trouble. I'm a filmmaker myself, and I've run into a lot of difficulty pitching scripts, and I have a difficulty coming up with ideas that have African-American themes, but I'm not sure America is ready to see African-Americans in a light that is more positive, is more successful. You have a lot of films that are coming out that are very, very exploitive, that I just won't go to see.
And to give those filmmakers, as you describe it, Ifani, the power of being storytellers, not just for African-Americans, but for the entire culture. Ifani, you're terrific, and I'm glad you called. Let me put that, Tricia Rose, to you. A bittersweet element, do you see Spike Lee, despite the films that break out of black casting entirely, do you see him as a prisoner, or as Ifani says, as a prisoner of being a crier of all things African-American?
Well, there's no question that I think any successful and even some unsuccessful black artists would articulate that profound dialectic, and that is that to be black as an artist and to have that talent is a blessing and a curse in that it becomes both your muse, the thing that you have a great connection to, and the thing that you can never move beyond and be seen properly for moving beyond. In other words, when you tell a larger story that is includes African-American life, but maybe focuses on other constituencies, you develop an invisibility so that your blackness is always both your impediment and your calling card. And it's that tension that is very disturbing and troubling. I mean, it's something that, you know, we should really all be quite honest about. And I'm sure Mr. Lee, if he were here, would point out that, you know, while it is a great career of great success, I'm sure he's had difficulty raising funds for many films, and that, you know, he's been underfunded for great efforts for the same reason. So even at the top of the mountain, he's still not at the top of the right mountain and not at the highest point that he should be. And, you know, that's a really serious problem in terms of black creativity and the ability to both be part of that legacy and to choose to potentially move beyond it and be recognizable. I mean, it's a critical problem.
And Kalim F. talk about, what about the box office of Spike Lee's films as he's moved away from films that focused as much on black culture in particular? It's fallen off, if I'm looking at the numbers correctly here.
Yeah, you're right. From the first few films, from She's Gonna Have It to School Days to Do the Right Thing, all the way through to Malcolm X, his box office increased with every film. He was, as was rightly pointed out, working with very small budgets, even at this stage. And then when he came to make Malcolm X, which was his first film of a bigger budget, which was $33 million, but still very small when you consider the scope and epic of that film, which was 3 hours long. That film was the start of, although that broke even and is in numbers alone his biggest box office to date, it was the start of a tailing off. And I believe that the tailing off came for a number of reasons. One was around that time, 1991 was the year of the black film, where in Cannes there were several films, there was the John Singleton film, the Hudlin Brothers, all rising, and the black audience got more, and also the American audience got more choice of the type of films they wanted to watch. And Spike then veered into a different direction and started making films. I think there was a couple there that weren't as good. There was Girl Six, definitely falls into that category. And he started to lose a bit of his fan base. And also at that stage, what you've got to remember, in the 90s, he had his own business, he had his own shops. He was leading the way in terms of black artists doing their own clothing lines. And he was everywhere, and I think there was a rejection of that. And it's been hard for him to pull the audience back because he's always had to work with very low budgets.
Kaleem Aftab, Tricia Rose, if you'll stand by, we have Spike Lee now, though not in the studio as we'd hoped. I think we've got him on a cell phone from somewhere in traffic in his New York. Spike Lee, are you there, my friend?
How you doing? I really want to apologize, but it's crazy cat. It's raining crazy cats and dogs here. We've been stuck. We left like almost 9 minutes ago to try to get to the studio, but I'm here on the phone. How are you doing?
We're glad to have you on the phone. We're sorry for your trouble on the highway, and we're glad to have Kaleem Aftab. And Tricia Rose is with us as well. Spike, you may know her. She's at the University of California, Santa Cruz, a great interpreter of many things, including your work. But we're happy to have you at last with us here. Kaleem Aftab was just taking us. We've talked about a lot already, so we're not just looking at your box office, but it's the subject. It's the point we are when you come in. What do you make of the arc of box office on your films, and the fact that it seems to have tapered off some as you moved beyond depicting black culture and black themes?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that. You have to realize that first, when I first started, Robert Townsend and I were really only directors, you know, making films. And it was an event, so as we got along in the years, there are many other black directors, so African American always had more than one director, more than one film to go to, so I wouldn't agree with that assessment.
But as you've moved into films, Summer of Sam and others famously, do you feel you're changing, your audience is changing? I mean, you initially focused She's Gotta Have It, of course, and Do the Right Thing and Jungle Fever. There was a tighter focus on black culture. Has it changed your audience as you've moved into to sort of a broader slice of the culture?
No, I don't think so, because number one, you know, I don't think it really defines someone's audience just by the first film that come out, you know, and I think that if you want to look who my audience is, look at the films we've done over the 20 years. You know, it'll be 20 years next year, 2006.
It's a lot of films. Where do you see yourself in the arc of that career at this point, Spike Lee?
Well, still growing. I mean, as I tell people all the time, when I was in film school, I read a quote by one of the world's master filmmakers, Akira Kurosawa, the great Japanese filmmaker, and he said this at 85, I think it was, that he said there was a universe of cinema he was still yet to learn. So when I read that in film school, that was a wake-up call right away that, you know, you should be about growth, learning, and all that, you know, till they dig in your grave.
Hey, Tom,
Tricia,
do you mind if I ask a question?
Yes.
Spike, I was just wondering, you know, do you think that there's a one of the things we were talking about before you came on, I don't know if you got to hear any of it, was this sort of complexity of being both an artist and a black artist, and the ways in which that impacts how audience members see your work, and whether or not there might be more comfort with when you tell stories about black people as opposed to when you tell stories that are not only about black people. Have you noticed any difference in terms of your own career in that regard?
It's a great question. We've got to take a short break, Spike Lee. We're going to go away for just a second. We'll come back and look straight at it. Artist, black artist, Spike Lee is with us, filmmaker extraordinaire. 20 years coming up since his first big breakout film, She's Gotta Have Us, Have It. Kalim Aftab and Tricia Rose are with us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Spike Lee.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at babsoncapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with filmmaker Spike Lee about his work and life, his life and work in American cinema. We had a little trouble with Cats and Dogs Rain in New York, but he's in the house now via cell phone. Also with us, Kalim Aftab, the As Told To author of the new biography, Spike Lee, That's My Story, and I'm Sticking to It. And we're delighted to have with us as well Tricia Rose, professor of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz, author of Black Noise. She raises the question for Spike Lee, the complexity of being an artist and a black artist and the expectations that surround that. Spike Lee, how do you respond?
Well, I think that, as Ms. Rose knows, that you have to go back to Dubois talked about the duality of all of us who were descendants of ex-slaves. You have that duality of being American and being black. And when I first started out, as I said before, it's really just Robert Townsend and I. So when you have, when it's on, nobody else there out there but you, there's this unfair thing that happens where you have to represent the whole race. In 1986, almost 20 years ago, when Good Habit came out,
mm-hmm.
you know, Nola Dahlen had to represent every single African-American woman, and that's just crazy, you know.
Right.
When I wrote the script, that was not what I was thinking about. If you look at the film that came out that year, what other films through independent, you know, had the lead characters African, young African-American woman?
Almost none, maybe none.
I think Whoopi might have had.
Okay.
I can't remember. But those are the things that, you know, the unfair stuff that's put on your shoulders, but you know that going in.
It's unfair, maybe, but you carry it, and you carry it still. Spike Lee, a lot of people want to speak with you among our listeners. I want to turn to them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul's calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Before I make my comment, I just want to say one thing to Spike, and that is go Celtics.
to the ultimate Knicks fan, you're cruising here.
I come to say go Red Sox.
Don't rub it in.
2 weeks too late. Anyway, my comment, it was really about Miss Rose's comment and the kind of duality of the black artist. And I think there's one fundamental problem with the word artist here, and that is when we're talking about major motion pictures, we're talking about movies, we're really not talking about artists with a capital A. We're talking about capitalists. And Hollywood is interested in money and box office success. And I wouldn't want to measure Spike Lee's movies that way. I think that the movies are fantastic. And to make a good movie is not going to translate to box office success. It's not going to translate to Hollywood money. They're interested in other things.
Paul, stick with us for a minute. That's a very good question. And I think Spike Lee may have a different angle here.
There are no artists working in film today? That film is not an art form? Is that what you're saying?
No. I'm just saying that when we're talking about Hollywood, We're talking about the measure for Hollywood. We're talking about box office success. I think there's any number of artists, but they tend to be independent. And to me, your movies are quintessentially independent and should not be tied up with these questions of getting funding from Hollywood.
Paul, we've got it. And I want to look at Spike Lee. I read a long story here of you going for that money.
Here's the thing. I'm an independent filmmaker, but at the same time, if you look at the roster of my films, a lot of my films have been financed and distributed by the studios. And I understand that. And if you're not going to continue to get funding if your films at least don't break even. So it's a very, you know, that's one of the things that you know going into the game when you want to make work in this level, you know, as a filmmaker.
Spike Lee, you're sort of famous for being open to the marketing side of this and not being resistant to the capital A or capitalist side of the movie-making endeavor. Is there tension there for you, or have you just worked both sides of that equation?
No, look, there's nothing heroic historically about black artists, black musicians being broke and poor while the record companies or the movie companies make all the money. There's nothing heroic about that. So if you're an artist and your work generates income, then you should, I think, as the great line in The Godfather, be able to wet your beak also. So I have no problem with getting money with the stuff that I'm generating.
And it wasn't always easy, as we read in wonderful detail, as told by Kalim Aftab. I wish you'd share with us, Spike Lee, the story of your grandmother, Zimmy, and the very important role her social security checks played in the creation of Spike Lee Filmmaker.
Yes, my dear grandmother, Zimmy Shelton, is still alive. She's 99 years old, lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and she taught art for 50 years. Not a rich woman at all. Just saved her Social Security check, so if her grandchildren wanted to go to college, they could. And so I'm her first grandchild, and she put me through Morehouse College, which is Atlanta, Georgia, and then she put me through NYU, the graduate film program, and she gave me the seed money for She's Gotta Have It, too.
And we're talking the critical sort of $20,000 that were the nut of getting that film. There was a lot more fundraising to be done, but this is not the money in the Christmas card. This is critical to your career.
Well, it was very critical. Another person I'd like to mention, his name is Earl Smith. Earl Smith went to high school together, and his mother died suddenly, and he came into a little bit of money, insurance. And it was all the money he had. His mother just died, and he invested, and She's Gotta Have It.
We read how you went person to person to person to person, hat in hand, and put the financing for that together. And at the heart of it, your grandmother, Zimmy. It's an incredible story. Let's take another caller. Che is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Che. You're on the air.
Hi. This is Che. How are you doing? And Spike, how are you doing out there?
Wet, but I'm doing all right.
Good. And thanks for the opportunity. My question is, I noticed that I'm originally from Ghana, West Africa, and I came here in 1978. So I went to college, and I decided to stay, and I'm working for a company here and everything. So I have a whole myriad of experience that I can account to. But I noticed that you haven't made any film that reflects the African experience or incorporate the African experience to the American experience.
So reaching across to the old country in a way. Spike Lee, what about it?
Well, you know, we went to Africa to shoot Malcolm X. We shot in South Africa, shot in Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely a story to be made, and I will do it before I'm done.
You're still drawn to that. You still think and talk a lot about slavery. Might that be the thread that you trace back to Africa?
Well, it has to be, and I would just like to mention very quickly that my wife and I, Tanya, took our DNA test. Now African Americans are finally able to find out where ancestors were stolen from, and it's easy. All you do is take a Q-tip and rub it inside of your cheek, and they mail it, and you mail it in. And I found out that on my father's side, my ancestors are from Cameroon.
Yeah.
The region now known as Cameroon, and my mother's side, my ancestors of the region now known as Sierra Leone. So that was great, the You know, I'm being Alex Haley. You know, everybody's not that be Alex Haley now. You just rob your Q-tip and you can find out where your ancestors are from.
This is the test that, Oprah's been talking a lot about, and you took it.
Yeah, it was like a year ago I took it.
That is fascinating. Spike, it's been said today on the show before you came on, and you yourself have said that your mother's passing was critical to turning to this career. Why? How?
Well, my mother was the one that kept her foot in my butt. My father, you know, whatever we could do was okay, but my mother was the one, she knew I needed to be motivated, and she kept her foot on my neck. And so she was never satisfied. If I had a test, I came on the B+, be very proud. She said, how come you didn't get an A? I got an A. She said, how come you didn't get an A+? And so she just really instilled in me the need, the wanting to do the best you can. And also, she also instilled in me a great work ethic. You know, I'm not lazy. You know, I work 24/7. And I got that from my mother.
Let me ask you about something else. You've been critical of films like The Color Purple, though complimentary to Steven Spielberg, but critical for the way black men have been portrayed, or putting forward the bad black man as kind of the front image. Does that relate at all to your own relationship with your dad, which we've heard a little bit about here today?
No, not at all. I think that... Also, I'd like to expand that, though. I mean, the films have been critical with the experience of African-American. Their African-American experience has not just been the depiction of African-American men. It's been, you know, women, you know, as a whole. And also, especially when you look at it now with these music videos. So I don't think it's that narrow-minded.
You brought a lot of the new music into film. Grandmaster Flash era music, you helped introduce that to a broad public. What do you think of the way that's evolved in the videos you're talking about now?
I wasn't Grandmaster Flash. It was Public Enemy would Do the Right Thing. But I love hip-hop. I'm just not a fan of this subgenre of hip-hop, which is pimp rap and gangster rap. I just think it's detrimental to the evolution of people in general, not just black people, because majority of rap CDs are bought by young white youth.
Don't we know it? Saeed is calling from Mattapan, Massachusetts. Hi, Saeed. You're on the air.
Hello. How are you doing?
We're well. What do you think, my friend?
Well, first of all, I wanted to congratulate Spike on his success, but I also wanted to ask about, could you tell me about the movie Bamboozled, which was my favorite movie, and how you was able to hit the industry, both actors and the industry, with your double-edged sword? And... the obstacles that you endured to have the movie completed, but also just to go straight to video.
Well, I'm sorry, sir. It might have seemed like it went straight to video, but we did get a theatrical release with that film.
Bamboozled, the film about black minstrels, blacks playing out of desperation, blackface.
Yes, but we really attacked the entertainment industry, specifically film and television. It was a great struggle to get that film made, and when it came out, we did not have a lot of support. That is why you just said that. I mean, it's not true, but what you said is in actuality probably true, because to a lot of people, it seemed it did go straight to video, because it never got to a theater where they lived.
Didn't show up, but there it was on video. Spike Lee, we know you're working now on The Inside Man with Denzel Washington as a New York police officer. We talked earlier about all the African-American actors and actresses that you helped bring to the fore. You're also working on this documentary, When the Levee Broke, about the aftermath of hurricanes.
Yeah, When the Levee Broke.
Yeah.
It's going to be for HBO, and we're going to take a unique approach. You know, not the History Channel thing, but a unique approach. No disrespect to the History Channel, but a unique approach to just this thing that happened in the Gulf Coast.
Well, give us a foretaste of the Spike Lee take. You saw the same images we all saw in the days immediately after. You saw the country's response to the scenes in the convention center and beyond. What did you make of the images and the reality that we saw coming out of New Orleans?
Well, number one, it was a shame. And the United States was embarrassed in front of the world. And I think we're going to take, again, we're going to use music to be our entree into looking at what happened in New Orleans. New Orleans being the birthplace of the blues, and music is going to be our entree.
Let me get one more call here. John is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I've really enjoyed Talking Point, and I never thought I'd have the chance to say hello to Spike Lee himself.
How are you doing, sir?
Film studies at the University of Rhode Island, and I tell you, the achievement of still a relatively young—I'd like to say young—a young director, Spike. Your achievement is truly, truly awesome, and I wish you many more years of productive
work. Thank you very much.
Work.
I appreciate it.
I can't say that enough. It's truly a remarkable achievement. I also get opportunities to teach Marlon Riggs, of course, and Tongues Untied and some of
right.
his other documentaries. And as you were referring, kind of like that duality, that double consciousness of which Du Bois talks about, and Marlon Riggs is so conscious of that.
Marlon Riggs, the gay black director.
Yes,
right.
yes. And also we can even talk about a triple consciousness, that he's black, he's an artist, black American.
John, our time is short. Take us to it, my friend.
Okay. But that he's also a gay man, and of course he explores in his films the just how rough it is to be black and also gay. And also, Spike, he implicitly there's a clip in Tongues Untied, and
right.
he's kind of raising the specter, the possibility of that it's also very hard for an artist like yourself.
John, we feel your question coming to it. We've got to have it right now.
Okay.
Time short.
And that is, how do you situate your own work with regard to the documentary work of Marlon Riggs?
And a gay black director, Spike Lee?
Well, I think that he used a clip from School Days, if I'm not mistaken. And here's the thing. If I have a character, because I had this argument with the Advocate magazine, too.
Hmm.
Because they said that I was homophobic because I had my character saying the word faggot or punk.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you're an artist, all your characters in your work cannot have the same, in my opinion, the same viewpoint that you have. So when I looked at Martin Scorsese, he's one of my favorite filmmakers, and look at his, the way he has his Italian Americans in his films, the way he used the N-word and Moulin and stuff like that, but I think Martin Scorsese used those words? No. But in his world, where he grew up in Little Italy, in the Bronx, those cats, that's the way they think about African-Americans. So you have to be very careful to make that distinction, I think.
And there goes Spike Lee with the passion on and the cell phone breaking. Spike Lee, we're grateful. We're sorry you missed the studio, but we're glad you called in on the phone. We wish you luck with When the Levee Broke and with The Inside Man. And thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you very much.
Filmmaker Spike Lee. We have also been joined, and very happy to be so, by Tricia Rose, Professor of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Tricia, a final question to you. Spike and women, are you happy as a black woman with the way he's done it?
I mean, as a critic of black culture especially, I've been generally really impressed. I do hope and wish we had kept more time with him, because I was hoping to ask him about the absence of black women filmmakers and just the unbelievable gap in that regard, that so many men have been able to follow in his footsteps.
We'll keep our eyes open to that, but I'm afraid our time runs short today. Tricia, great having you.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Kaleem Aftab, author of Spike Lee, That's My Story and I'm Sticking to It. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.